This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Modern agriculture has been criticized for many things. Its carbon footprint, its reliance on synthetic fertilizers and pesticides, the rising prevalence of genetically modified organisms, just to name a few. But one thing is undeniable. Today's farmers are producing more food using less land than ever before in history. For example, here in the U.S., farmers currently grow 40% more potatoes on 20% less land than they did less than half a century ago. And that could be a very good thing for a lot of other plants and animals. That's the upshot of recent research by Dr. Jesse Ozabel. He's director of the Program for the Human Environment at the Rockefeller University and adjunct faculty at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He was instrumental in organizing the first UN climate conference and a large-scale survey of life in the ocean. Through his work, Ozabel envisions a large, prosperous society that emits little or nothing harmful and spares large amounts of land and sea for nature. Jesse Ozabel is here with us today to share his optimistic view of our environmental future. Jesse Ozabel, it's great to have you back on the show.
Good to be with you, Heather.
I hope you'll also join our conversation later this hour. We'll take your calls and emails. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Living Lab Radio. Now, Jesse Ozabel, you, in talking about this work you've been doing recently on trends in agriculture and land use, have kind of, you know, there's this phrase peak oil that I think we're all familiar with. You say we've kind of reached peak agriculture, at least in terms of use of land for agriculture. So where does this idea come from? What's the data that's gone into the idea that you're currently working with?
Heather, the key phrase is peak farmland. For many decades, people have worried that humans will run out of good land, arable land, cropland for growing food. But what we actually see around the world now in the last 30, 40 years is a flattening of the amount of land used for agriculture and increasingly abandonment of agricultural land. At the same time, food production keeps rising, more calories, more protein. So we've seen this decoupling of the production of food from land since the middle of the 20th century. And with the slowing of population growth, fewer bellies, fewer forks being added each year, it now seems that there's a real chance that we're at the peak use of farmland, not because we're running out of it, but because the demand for the products of the farmland can be met with the existing land we're using, and in fact can be used with less. So there's a real chance that we can release tens of millions of acres of land in coming decades for other uses.
Is this a global trend or simply here in the United States?
It is a global trend. We've looked at many countries. And for example, the place where the phenomenon is most advanced, most visible, is in the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. In the last 20 years there, somewhere between 30 million and 60 million hectares of land, that's a land area about the size of Poland, which is a big country, has been abandoned from cropland. And so there's this tremendous rewilding, return of nature, restoration of nature in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, forests coming back, animals coming back. And of course, for New England, it's easy to understand because, after all, this area was shaved of forests in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, and now there's lots of woodland again all over New England, even on Martha's Vineyard. And now the battle is to save farms because we like having farms as part of the landscape.
So when you talk about this rewilding, I love that word, rewilding. Can natural ecosystems really return? Do we have data and evidence that we can get back healthy natural ecosystems in places where we've had these farms?
The future won't be a replica of the past, but I personally believe there can be a tremendous return of nature. Some of us have started using the phrase global greening also. When I started my career in the 1970s, all of us were expecting a global browning. We thought the biosphere would shrink and die. And instead, for a variety of reasons now, we see a global greening in many parts of the world, in the northern areas, the boreal and Arctic polar areas, but especially in the temperate parts of the world. The biosphere is growing again. It's getting bigger. And that's happening for two sets of reasons. A bottom-up set of reasons, which I've already mentioned. The farmers don't need to use as much land to produce food, so a lot of land is just returning to other uses, predominantly woodlands. And then also, for other reasons that, of course, are somewhat more worrisome or ambiguous, the growing seasons seem to be getting longer because of climate change. There's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is food for plants. There's more nitrogen around. So for those reasons, also, the biosphere is growing. So now satellite imagery comparing the year 2010, say, with 1990, in many regions of the world, show more biosphere, not less biosphere.
Now, perhaps I'm cynical, but I could imagine a scenario in which farmland decreases and that land is immediately developed for other uses. So what makes you optimistic that it will actually be allowed to return to a natural state as opposed to perhaps becoming a housing development or some other industry?
Cities and pavements, of course, are another use of land, another form of land cover. The total area that human settlements cover and human structures is small, let's say less than 5%, probably 3% of the land area. That will increase in the future. How much it increases depends on the mix of how we design our cities. We can go up, and I come from Manhattan, and of course I'm a believer in vertical cities. Vertical cities save nature. New York saves a lot of nature by not spreading out the way Los Angeles has, for example. So it's a question of whether you build out or whether you build up with cities. But even if you build out, cities take only a small fraction of the land. The big uses of land by humanity are farmland, which is covers 10 times as much area as cities. Agriculture is by far the biggest use, and that's
crop. Do you happen to know, it, like percentage-wise, what percentage of global land area goes to farming?
I think it's about 30% or so. And a lot of land is also used for grazing and range land. That's a big chunk. And then, of course, a lot of land is forest, and some of that is logged actively by the wood products industry or logged by people who live in the forests more modestly. And then there's a lot of forest, of course, which is largely unused by humans still. And, of course, we'd like to see that proportion grow as well.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Jesse Ozabel about his research on trends in land use for agriculture and how the choices we make each day shape the American landscape. So what are the technological or perhaps social changes that have led to this increasing efficiency of farming, the need to use less land and still produce more calories?
Both the growers, the farmers and foresters, and the consumers have big impacts. Let me first speak about what farmers and foresters do. Farmers get smarter. Farming keeps getting better in many, many ways. Farmers want land is expensive. It's one of the inputs, of course. And so farmers, in order to have profitable crops, in most cases, farmers want to grow more on the same area of land. And for a long time, that meant using more inputs, using more water or more fertilizer. And people refer to that as intensification. But what's happened over the last few decades is not an increase in the stuff going into the land, but greater precision in the use of inputs and actually economy in the use of inputs. So the real development in farming is precision agriculture, where it's more bits and fewer kilowatts, so to say. It's the 21st century. So better weather forecasts, better seeds, chemicals that can be used more parsimoniously. So farmers are growing more, but they're spacing plants differently. Harvesting machines that do less damage to the land. They drill seeds in a very customized way to exactly the right depth. So there's a whole set of techniques that's come along with precision agriculture, which is resulting in higher yields, but not actually more inputs. Also, water. People worry about water, but in the United States, water withdrawals at present are the same as they were more than 30 years ago, while we've added 80 million people to this country, the population of Turkey, and of course, the total production of food, not just for us, but for export, has gone up. So we're growing a lot more food with the same or less water than we used to. So I don't like the term intensification and don't use it myself because the kind of progress that farmers has made hasn't involved using more stuff. It's involved using less stuff and using it more smartly. The other side is consumers. And let me here use the example of forests, the iPad. People talked about the paperless office and the paperless home for a long time, and we're finally moving in that direction. An e-reader replaces an awful lot of pulp and paper. And so for a long time, the wood products industry was growing because there were more and more newspapers being sold in America, all over the world, in magazines. And now that's dropping sharply. So consumers, by changing their behavior, also affect the need for these products.
So when you were here 2 years ago on the show, you were talking in part about this trend toward increasing efficiency. As you just mentioned, the one example you gave is that we used to have a phone and a camera and a watch and a handful of other devices, and now we have one smartphone. Do you see this trend in agriculture as part of a broader, perhaps fundamentally human drive to become more efficient?
Yes, I would say there are lots of reasons for economy on the part of the farmers and foresters. Again, if you can shave the inputs, if you can use less land, a smaller volume of chemicals, less water, you pay less, and you can get the same or more revenue. For consumers, it's a mixed picture. A lot of this dematerialization, as we call it, is taking place. So a smartphone is replacing a lot of gear that people used to carry around with them or have in their homes. When it comes to food, though, the great question is how much, we're getting bigger and taller and heavier. So a lot of us would benefit from dematerializing a little bit with food and eating less and eating a bit smarter. There are just hints, finally, in the last year or two in the U.S. that the so-called obesity epidemic is plateauing. There have been some reports that obesity is actually down in the last year or two. That would be a wonderful thing. But so far, we seem to be eating more. Of course, there's the question of the composition of our diet, and maybe we can talk about that a little bit later on.
We will absolutely talk more and more specifically about that in a little bit. But you're starting to touch on another relationship that's very important here, and that's the relationship between income or wealth and food production and food choices. And you say that not only has food production become decoupled from land use, it's become decoupled from income. So what's going on there?
That's right. Well, in the as people get richer, they only spend a little bit more of that money on protein and calories. They spend a lot of that money on telecommunications and on education and on tourism and all kinds of other things. They only spend a little bit more on calories and protein. And most of that, in recent years, Americans are spending by going out to eat. So the restaurant industry may be doing well. The food retail industry may be doing well, but the farmers aren't getting more revenue. So, if you buy a big bag of potato chips for $6 or $7, for example, you're buying about half a potato. So you're buying enjoyment of the experience, you're buying convenience, but you're not buying a lot of potato. And the same is true when you go to a restaurant. You're paying people to serve you food, to wash the plates. You're paying for a nice atmosphere. You're paying to have a choice when you sit down. But you're not actually buying three potatoes instead of two potatoes or 10 shrimp instead of 5 shrimp.
You're also potentially paying for a lot of food wastage when you go out to a restaurant.
Food waste is one of the little discussed and really terrible phenomena of our age. There have been some studies by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN and other groups that suggest that a third of food is wasted in the rich countries. A big fraction of what the foods that restaurants buy is thrown away because of rules having to do with safety, hygiene. Anything on it that's been on a plate can't be preserved. And people aren't much better in their homes. Lots of food rots in people's refrigerators. People put portions on their plates more than they want to eat at home and throw it away. And in the poorer countries, of course, you still have problems with rats and mice and birds and so forth making off with food. So when you look at the food waste, if we could reduce food waste, that's another reason that we don't need more land. So all of these things add up to the possibility of a restoration of nature, of this global greening, of the idea that we can have more choice in the future about land that we have used for farms and for forests, and maybe allow nature to have some of it back.
So some conservation and efficiency on the user end as well as the producer's end.
Yes, very important.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Jesse Ozabel, Director of the Program for the Human Environment at Rockefeller University. We'll talk more and hear from you after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's easy to feel like our individual actions don't have much effect when it comes to some of the major environmental problems we face. Things like climate change and mass extinction are just so big. But Jesse Ozabel of Rockefeller University, my guest today, argues that our daily food choices are shaping the landscape around us with major ramifications for both climate and biodiversity. We want to know whether environmental concerns play into your food choices. Call us toll-free at 866-999-4626, send email to livinglabradio@wgbh.org, or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Tell us what you're eating these days and why. Now, Jesse Ozabel, if we look at the trends that you've been studying recently, how have American food choices played into these trends? We've talked about some of the technological innovations, but there are also some consumer choices that have played into how farmland is currently used.
There are two crops have taken over the American landscape, corn and soybeans. Now, corn, of course, is an original crop of the Americas. But it's grown and grown and grown, and now about, by tonnage, about half of all the output of American agriculture is corn. But farmers can't sell all that corn to people. In fact, only about 10% of the corn that farmers grow is actually eaten directly by humans. A big chunk of it is fed to animals. So when you're eating a hamburger or a pork chop, you're actually really eating corn. And about a third of all the corn that Americans now grow is fed to automobiles, which I think is an abomination, but a result of the Iowa primaries and other aspects of American politics. Corn growers have been so successful in growing corn that humans can't eat it all. So they're trying to add value by turning it into meat or whiskey or automotive fuel. So corn has really taken over. And the second big crop is soybeans. Soybeans were scarcely existed as a crop until about 1940. And now they're the second largest crop. And some of that turns into tofu, but most of it turns into chicken. So when you're eating chicken, you're really eating soybeans. And of course, as many people have pointed out, the fraction of meat that's in our diets is probably bigger than it should be, and so if people eat a bit less meat, then you're actually using less land because that land is being used to grow the feed that makes the meat, and you can eat the crops directly. So that's one big example: the corn and the soybeans. On the other end, potatoes are in trouble, and potatoes are also an original American crop going back to the Incas and so forth. And potatoes are a wonderful food, but because we don't want to spend a lot of time shopping and cooking anymore, the traditional boiled potatoes, mashed potatoes, baked potatoes are a smaller part of our diet, and potatoes, in terms of land use, are one of the most efficient crops. You can grow a lot of potatoes on an acre of land, and very little in a potato is fed to animals. A little bit, tiny bit maybe feed, but very, very, really a negligible fraction. So when you're eating potatoes, in a sense, you're doing a green thing inherently. Now, I would say mashed or baked is probably better than French fries, but from that point of view, the simple choices you make actually turn into the American landscape.
Well, and even as you're saying that, you know, I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, if you're choosing just to do the baked or the, you know, the potato that way as opposed to French fries, there's also then if you're not doing a lot of French fries, there's going to be less demand for canola or certain other crops. I mean, there are so many different ramifications of every small choice that we make as consumers, even just as to how a certain food is prepared, let alone which different foods we choose.
There's the eat-in, eat-out choice as well. Americans spend about 20 minutes a day on average preparing food and about 15 minutes a day shopping. The vegetables are usually sort of in the far periphery of the supermarket, so you have to use up more of your precious seconds of shopping to find them.
So you would like to see grocery stores redesigned to have produce right down the middle?
Potatoes should be right there when you walk in the store. People used to buy 5 and 10 pound bags of potatoes. Now they don't. All of these habits make a big difference. But convenience, of course, is very important, and you know many people work now to make a living and so forth. And there are some ways, of course, to make frozen foods and dried foods and so forth that can make access to some of these products better. But you really have to look at what people do versus what they say. A lot of people, I think, have good intentions about their diet, but when you actually look at what's being sold in America and around the world and how people actually behave, there, of course, is often a big gap.
Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Joel, how have environmental concerns shaped your food choices?
Well, they pretty much ruined it. I used to have a few goats around here and dozens of chickens, a good dog, some cats and myself, and I lived for 40 years off the land with no income whatsoever, and you can't do any of that now. I'm now surrounded by hundreds of houses, and that brings up what I'd like to refer to, and we can get it out of the way. This is really a good program covering good material, but I think I heard your guest mention something about 80 million people have been added to the population of this country, and I don't remember the time span he mentioned, but it's a subject that nobody wants to talk about, and I'm curious to hear how population growth factors into all these good things that's being mentioned on this show.
All right. Well, that's absolutely definitely a point we want to get to. Jesse Ozabel, there are some big ifs, particularly going forward with this trend. You know, you see the decrease of land use for farming, but that's predicated on some pretty big ifs, one of which is slow population growth. And I think the idea that population growth has slowed, even that idea is kind of surprising because we're so used to worrying about how many people there are and the fact that we're at 7 billion now and projected to be at 9 billion by 2050. That doesn't seem slow.
We've mentioned peak oil and peak farmland already. 2012 or 2013 was probably the year of peak child also. The number of children who will be added, of human children, who will be added to the planet in 2014 is likely to be smaller than last year and 2 years ago for the first time in hundreds of years, maybe since the 30 Years' War in the 17th century, when there was such a big loss of population that there fewer children were born, or the days of the Black Death in the Middle Ages. So the year 1970 or so was the year of the peak rate of growth of the human population. We were adding about 2% per year to the human population. Now we're adding about 1%. So we've halved the rate of human population growth, and now it's come. The rate has come down such that the absolute numbers being added are finally falling. The demographers don't have a great track record of forecasting. You couldn't find anybody in 1970 who predicted peak child for 2013. But so one always has to be careful about what will happen in the future. But many people think that the population will stabilize in the next 30 to 75 years, maybe somewhere around 9 billion, perhaps 10. That's a significant increase, but I think many people feel manageable.
All right. Well, Joel, thank you so much for that call. If you want to call us with your questions or to share how you've shaped your food choices around environmental concerns, you can give us a call at 866-999-4626 or send email to livinglabradio@wgbh.org. You can also find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. I want to go back to some of these consumer choices that you were talking about earlier, and particularly the choice that we have to make as a society as a whole between using farmland to produce human food and using farmland to produce either feed for animals or even, as you were calling it, feed for cars, fuel. So why do you think that, in particular, the using farmland to produce fuel for biofuel is such a bad idea?
It's an extremely inefficient use of the land. Basically, we pour 1 gallon of, I'll call it oil, onto a bit of land in order to get out 1.2 gallons.
So in pouring the oil on the land, you mean the carbon footprint of the machinery and whatever else goes into the chemicals?
The inputs to get the 1.2 gallons of ethanol or biodiesel, in order to get that, you need tractors and you need fertilizer and a range of other inputs. So you're putting a lot, what's called the energy return on investment for the biofuels is very, very low. So it's just a very wasteful way. One should have a ratio of 10 or 20 or 50 to 1, not 1.2 to 1.
Even with those inefficiencies, though, couldn't you eventually set up a system where the oil being poured into that input was all biofuel, that essentially you had kind of a circular system, but we wouldn't be using any fossil fuel? Wouldn't that be an improvement?
Well, but then you'd need to use an enormous amount of land, and we wouldn't be able to have this great restoration of nature and rewilding. As I say, about 30% of the land used for corn in the United States is now being used to feed cars, roughly an area the size of the state of Iowa or the state of Alabama. I'd much rather release that land for other uses and have a Buffalo Commons, a return of prairies. I think there are lots of other good things we could do. Now, some non-food uses of crops are wonderful, of course. We grow linen for clothing. Of course, there's the return of the hemp crop, and hemp is good for rope and for clothing and other things as well. So, but in those cases, you're making products that are, I would say, smart from the point of view of, we want linen, it's special, but to produce diesel fuel, we can, if for the purpose of mobility, there are lots of ways humans can achieve mobility. We can electrify cars. We can build magnetically levitated trains. We can run cars on hydrogen produced either by nuclear or solar means. So we don't need to disturb the land in order to get the fuels for mobility.
Well, and in fact, this is a little bit off in another direction, but you also argue that in addition to peak oil and peak farmland and peak child, we may have reached peak car, that car usage may be on the decline.
That's correct. We've posted a paper on our website at Rockefeller University, a paper called Cars and Civilization, in which we argue that peak car may also be occurring just about now. If you look at the U.S., but also the U.K. and some other societies, it looks like the total population of automobiles is nearing saturation, and the amount that we're driving has definitely saturated. There's really been, the last 10 years or so, the amount that Americans are driving per capita, but even absolutely, is also really, really flattening. So it may be that we're actually nearing peak everything, or almost everything, maybe not peak cell phone, but we're many, many of the material things that we've been concerned about, water, cars, use of cropland, it may be that in the U.S. and other developed countries, we're now at the peak of the use of these things and that they'll even fall. Now, of course, in China and India and other parts of the world, there will still be rises, at least for another two or three decades. But it may be that globally, by the middle of the 21st century, we really see a very new kind of economy in which very little, much less in the way of new resources are being deployed, and the human footprint in nature really stabilizes and even shrinks.
Now, we touched on this earlier, but with the shrinking footprint of humanity, shrinking farmland, some are really concerned about the loss, in particular, of some of the smaller, more traditional farms, the disappearance of farms from our landscape. Is that just nostalgia in your view, or should there be some concern and some effort to make sure that farms are part of our landscape?
Farms can be an adornment of the landscape as well as essential for providing the food. I think we'll move in the direction of a kind of bifurcated economy for crops in which a lot is produced in a kind of industrial way, but a small fraction, but an extremely important fraction, is produced in a traditional artisanal way.
And why do you see that as being important?
Well, I would say for flavor, literally, but also for sentimental reasons and preservation of the landscape in ways that we care. The French want France to look like France. Vermonters want Vermont to look like, I'll say, recent Vermont. In 1900, there were almost no forests in Vermont, but now we've become accustomed to a mix of dairy cows and woods and so forth, and people like it that way. So, I think it's worth, some farmers in the future will be, part of their job will be as landscape managers, landscape ecologists, keeping things in ways that people find attractive, as well as, again, I'll say again, providing the flavor. Because if you think of, let's take the example of tofu, maybe we'll be eating a lot more tofu, soybeans directly in the future. But of course, you want good flavor on the tofu. The tofu by itself doesn't have much taste. So if you can grow some delicious vegetables or have a very tasty fish sauce or whatever to put on the tofu or mushrooms, then you're getting your bulk calories and proteins from the tofu, which may be grown, in a quite industrial way, but you're also getting the flavor. And that means locally also, in places like Massachusetts, may be possible to keep some farmers in business. They'll in order for their farms to be profitable, they'll have to charge a lot for each potato they sell, so to say. But that mix of a kind of mixture of boutiques and industrial production could work. That's, after all, very much what we have in textiles, for example. Most people are buying blue jeans or whatever, and those are really industrially produced. At the same time, people love to have a scarf that they knitted themselves, or some item of clothing that they've bought at some small boutique, which is very special and adds identity and culture.
All right. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is Dr. Jesse Ozabel. We'll talk more after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with Dr. Jesse Ozabel. He's director of the Program for the Human Environment at Rockefeller University and adjunct faculty at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Some of his recent research focuses on how consumer choices and technological advances are decreasing the amount of land necessary for food production and what that could mean for nature, with a capital N. Now, Jesse Ozabel, we talked about kind of this large-scale choice between using land to produce human food and using it to produce something like fuel or a completely non-food product. But then in the middle, you've got the use of land to produce things like corn or soybeans that then become the food for the animals that we eat for protein. But there are some big differences depending on the choices you make between eating beef or say, eating chicken.
Heather, that's exactly right. Think of a cow or a pig or a chicken as a machine, as a different model of car. If you think that way, then a cow is cattle are like cars that get 20 miles to the gallon, and pigs get 40 miles to the gallon, and chickens get 60 miles to the gallon. Chickens are inherently much more efficient machines for producing meat. And when I look at the incredible success of chicken in America and around the world in the last 30, 40 years, chicken is the meat that's really winning. It's incredibly successful in the marketplace. The farmers are really replacing less efficient machines with more efficient ones. And so from a consumer point of view, also, if you're consuming poultry, you're it's like driving a Prius, so to say. Of course, it depends on how many ounces you eat too. So if you love the taste of beef, eat some, but keep in mind that if you're concerned about the environmental footprint, then a smaller portion may make sense. Even beyond the chicken, of course, is sea life.
Right. I was going to ask you about that. I mean, where does seafood fit into this picture?
Well, chickens still have to stand, and a lot of the energy of animals simply goes into staying upright and feeding. Fish are helped by water. So some of the fish that are successful in aquaculture, like tilapia and catfish, are even more efficient than chickens because the water does a lot of the work. Those tilapia and the catfish and are herbivores like the chickens. They so to say eat soybeans. Some of the sea life that we might like that's farmed, like salmon, eat ground up other small fish, and of course then we have to go out and harvest those fish from the oceans, and there's no real net gain of efficiency from that point of view. But I think if in the future people want to eat a lot of sea life, then it needs to be the herbivorous sea life that we can farm that way. So it can be the species like the tilapia and the catfish, or it can be the oysters and the mussels and the clams, which also are herbivores and can be farmed very efficiently from the point of view of the production of the meats.
Whether it's aquaculture or raising chickens or kind of industrial modern farming, even if we're doing a lot more with the same inputs, there are still a lot of environmental impacts. There's runoff of fertilizer and pesticides into waterways that then affects the ocean. There's concern with aquaculture, with whether there might be antibiotics that get into the environment or other things that get into the environment. Same thing with chickens, the use of antibiotics that's been part of this industrialization of chicken growth. Does your message of optimism need to be, do you think, tempered with some message that there are still improvements that need to happen in terms of the environmental footprint of agriculture?
There's fallout from everything we do. And so we have to be attentive always to the leaks, the pollution, the life cycle of products. And the answer is yes, of course. And I think in every occupation, if you look around, you'll see that there are good operators and bad operators. If you visit factories that produce a particular product, or if you just visit the homes of your friends, you know some people operate in that sense much better than others. And certainly in the wood products industries, farming industries, aquaculture, there's a spectrum of performance. And some people, some operators, I think, do a very good job and are very attentive to minimizing individual fallout and thus collective fallout, and others are quite sloppy. And so one needs surveillance and regulation. One needs feedback systems so that midnight dumpers, so to say, are caught, and that new people entering various occupations enter them with good training and alert to all these concerns, whether it's excessive use of antibiotics or other kinds of problems.
Talk about where how this trend relates to the fact that there are still places in the world with a significant hunger problem. How do we reconcile the fact that we're using less land to produce food with the fact that there are still a lot of hungry people in the world?
About 1 billion people are still hungry, maybe a little bit less than that. That's about the same number as 30 or 50 years ago. The good news is we've added, we've increased the population, and the fraction of the total population that's reasonably well fed has gone up. But there are still a lot of hungry people. It's hard to blame nature for that. I sometimes like to say nature pleads not guilty. And it's hard to blame humanity as a whole, because if you look at the total number of total amount of protein or the total number of calories produced around the world, including what's wasted, including all the calories that are diverted to meat, including the calories that are going into automobiles in the United States, there are enough calories by far, by let's say twice as many calories as humanity needs, including the 1 billion hungry people. So it's something else that we're not doing right.
It's a social problem, not a supply problem.
Yes, I would say it's a matter of it's a matter of getting income to poor people so that they can buy food products. It's a matter of creating more peaceful conditions in areas of conflict where food doesn't reach certain areas. So, yes, the problem of the problem of the 1 billion hungry is one of the great problems of humanity. It's not it's not primarily a problem of farmers or environmentalists.
Now, one of the other great problems we face, at least could be argued, is climate change. How do you see climate change impacting agriculture? And is there anything in this model of more efficient farming, is that more susceptible or perhaps more resilient to climate change?
Farming has tended to move in the 20th century into areas that we might have thought were not so attractive for farming. It used to be that people thought the tropics and hot places were no good for farming. Now, of course, an enormous amount of production, just look at the United States, is in the south of Texas or in the Southwest. So, in fact, people, sunshine is a precious commodity. So if you can bring water to hot, dry places, those are often excellent places to farm. Now, the difficulty is, of course, we don't really know how the climate's going to change. The climate's changing all the time. We seem to be accelerating it. I personally don't have much confidence in any particular production, particular forecast. If I lived in a particular county in Texas or in Florida or in potato country in Idaho, I wouldn't have a lot of confidence in any particular climate model. So you sort of have to hedge your bets.
And why not?
Well, there are dozens of different climate models. They agree only on the very broad description of what will happen, such as there'll be a 2 or 3 degree warming, but they don't agree on precipitation in Idaho. So it's completely a la carte. You can pick a model that will have more rain in a particular county or less.
But just as you've done with trends in agriculture, there certainly are trends that we are already seeing in terms of climate changes at the regional level that we could draw on. Here in the Northeast, we've seen a 70% increase in extreme precipitation in, I think, the last half a century, I believe it is. Why would we not think that would continue?
Well, you could choose. You could just extrapolate what's happened recently, if that's one option. But I would say the strategy would be to hedge in several directions and try to be ready. But as a whole, climate change will bring a mixture of effects. Again, if the growing seasons are longer, if there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that will tend to favor more crop production, greening. On the other hand, if access to water becomes more limited, then that's a problem. So it's hard. I'd say it's very hard to know. I would say if I were a farmer and trying to work on a fairly large scale of business, water is what would be foremost in my mind, and I would try to have backup plans both for getting rid of excess water and for bringing in water. So I think that the big investments by the society and by enterprises really need to be with regard to compensating if there are droughts and dealing with floods. I think those are activities that can take 5 and 10 and 20 and 30 years to prepare, to build the physical infrastructure, to learn new ways to do things. Also, water, people quarrel about it a lot. So you need lawyers too sometimes, or political decisions about how water might be reallocated if there were a very stressful circumstance. But climate is a kind of wild card. If there were only one global model and everybody agreed on exactly what would happen, it would be a lot easier. But then a lot of other things would be a lot easier, too.
There are a lot of very intelligent people, very concerned about climate change, about being able to produce enough food, about population growth, about water usage, a lot of these issues that we've touched on. And you tend to be very optimistic. You say you're not particularly afraid or worried about these challenges that we face. Where does that optimism come from?
No, I think a lot of people live life on the tangent, and I think a lot of people are still living with the information, the facts that we had in the 1970s or 1980s about these problems. And if you were looking backwards at the time when I began my career, it was natural to think things were just going to go up and up and up and up. But what's actually happened? It seems that peak farmland has happened, and it seems that in the U.S. peak water is happening. It seems that peak car may be happening. So, in fact, through technological progress, through behavioral changes, in many respects, the picture is improving. I'm not saying human behavior itself is improving. We still treat each other pretty wretchedly. All you have to do is listen to the news that will come up in another 5 minutes. But I think we've actually dealt quite well with a lot of environment and resource problems. Think of air pollution in cities. I grew up washing my face several times a day because the air in New York City was so sooty. And now New York has beautiful, clear air most of the time. So I think when you start to look at the data from the last 20 years, one sees a lot of encouraging signs. For example, in both India and China, the forested area has increased in these countries since 1990. And again, nobody would have forecast that. I wouldn't have forecast that in 1980. So, I think some of these inflection points, some of these turning points may be happening around now. We still have a lot of work to do, but the pressures may not be quite as extreme as we feared.
That's Dr. Jesse Ozabel, Director of the Program for the Human Environment at Rockefeller University. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Heather.
Dr. Jesse Ozabel will be speaking tomorrow evening, Tuesday, July 8th at 7:30 p.m. at the Wailing Church in Edgartown, if you'd like to hear more about his ideas. That's it for our show this week. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.